Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The documentary film Restrepo was shot during 15 months in the Korangal Valley, one of the most dangerous postings in Afghanistan. With it, viewers experience the dangers and boredom of the daily lives of the 2nd Platoon of Battle Company, which is part of a regiment in the 173rd Airborne Brigade. Restrepo is one of 15 films now being considered for the Academy Award for Best Documentary. We'll find out what makes it special. Today joining us are the documentary filmmakers, writer, journalist Sebastian Younger, and he's also the author of The Perfect Storm. Sebastian has reported from many war zones across the world. He has also written about his time in the Korangal Valley with the 2nd Platoon. Welcome to the show, Sebastian.
Thank you.
Tim Hetherington is a photographer and filmmaker who has reported on conflicts and social issues around the world for more than a decade. Tim is the recipient of 4 World Press Photo Awards. His next book about U.S. soldiers in the Korangal Valley is entitled Infidel. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Hey, thanks, Ann. Thanks for being on.
Tim, what does this film tell us about the plight of the average soldier in the war in Afghanistan now?
Well, you know, what we did was we made the most visceral and immersive war film we could. We just felt that that experience, you know, hasn't been widely seen in the States. I mean, we see, network news pieces, we see political opinion pieces, but we don't really see that their experience in the entirety. And what we do is we take you on a 90-minute journey into the Korangal, a place that when we arrived in 2007 was seeing nearly a fifth of all fighting in Afghanistan. So it's hard to kind of say that the Korangal Valley is representative of Afghanistan. It's like saying perhaps that Detroit is representative of America, mm-hmm. but it does show you what the nature of the extreme nature of combat is like.
Is it that they would be average soldiers anywhere? I mean, is there something special about them that they are sent to the valley that way, to this very dangerous place?
A renowned brigade within the U.S. military. They saw a lot of action in Vietnam. The one battalion we were with in World War II was dropped onto Corregidor Island. So they were pretty well known. And they generally, the military puts the best units in the worst places because they have the best chance of doing well and surviving. So these guys had a pretty good reputation. But no one realized how violent the Korangal was going to be, including Tim and myself. I'd never heard of the Korangal Valley, and it wound up that almost a fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan was happening in this little 6-mile-long valley at times when we were there. 150 men of battle company were absorbing all of that combat for 70,000 NATO troops across the country.
Now, forgive me if I'm incorrect, or correct me if I'm wrong, I should say, but you finished this documentary, at least finished filming it, before we knew that they were going to shift most of the major operations and the major war effort to Afghanistan from Iraq. Is that right?
Well, that started to kind of happen at the end of 2007, 2008. I mean, when we arrived in the Korangal on assignments, the world was very focused on Iraq.
Right.
And, we had no idea until we arrived that the war in Afghanistan was slipping out of control, something we now know to be true. And it kind of felt that by the end of 2007, 2008, I guess in 2008, that the focus started to go into Afghanistan, and obviously Petraeus was suddenly, much more concentrated on the effort there.
My guests are Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger, the filmmakers of Restrepo. It is one of the 15 documentary films that are in the running for in the 83rd Academy Awards. Again, I should say that Restrepo will make its world television premiere on the National Geographic Channel, unedited and with limited commercial interruption, on Monday, November 29th at 9 p.m. We'll have a link to all of that for if you want more information at wosu.org/allsides. How does their plot, their plight, I should say, perhaps differ than from what we might see in a drama? The documentary has been compared to The Hurt Locker and other, very dramatic depictions of war. How does it differ from that, Tim?
A Hollywood movie, they want you to step into the reality of the story and immerse yourself in it as if you were there. Documentaries usually have a point to make. They want to instruct you on an important topic, what they feel is an important topic. So they give you many different perspectives. They interview experts. You don't feel that you're there, but you're watching something very instructive. We wanted to sort of blend those two. We wanted to make a film, a completely immersive film, about what it feels like to be a soldier in combat. Soldiers can't cut to an interview with a diplomat to ask what's going on in Afghanistan. They can't do that. They're stuck in their situation. So we filmed this movie entirely in the Korangal Valley, a lot of it at this remote outpost called Restrepo. The camera never leaves the sides of these men. The only people you see in this movie are American soldiers who are fighting in the Korangal Valley. It's not about the wider war. It really is an immersive experience, a 90-minute deployment, if you will, in this very, very violent place.
You know, given the changes in technology and communications around the world, the situation, in a way, it could be anywhere in any war, but there is a lot more access to information about what's going on out there, isn't it? Are they still relatively insulated?
They were pretty cut off out there. I mean, when we first got to the outpost, we got there just as being built, and it was there was no running water or electricity. Hmm. You know, we slept up there in the dirt with the guys, and they were really, really cut off. Occasionally, every two weeks or so, a squad would rotate back to the valley floor where there was a larger outpost called the Korangal Outpost where they could get a hot shower and some cooked food. But they really were, for intents and purposes, cut off. It was another world up there.
I was going to ask, what were they eating? Because at the end of the film, some of them looked like they were half-starved. I mean, what do they feed them?
Well, they eat a thing called MREs, meals ready to eat, and it's a kind of, it's the American military's kind of packaged food, freeze-dried, it's kind of interesting for the first one, but by the kind of, the 300th one, you're starting to definitely get sick of the stuff.
What do you think was the advantage, or what do you think you gained as filmmakers by spending the entire deployment with them?
Well, we were able to absorb their experience. The war is a very political thing back here at home. It must be. War is a terrible thing, and it needs to be argued about, and, otherwise we might enter into wars too easily. The soldiers are not talking about the war that they're fighting in those terms, and so what our experience with them allowed us to do is to understand their reality, and my hope with this movie is that, I've been covering wars and human rights violations, human rights issues my entire career. I have some very strong emotions about war, some very conflicted feelings about war and about this war. But what we want with this movie is people from across the political spectrum who are for the war, against the war, liberal, conservative, doesn't matter, to be able to put their views on hold just for 90 minutes and sit in a theater and experience what our soldiers are going through. They volunteered to serve this country. This country sent them overseas to fight and possibly to die in a war very, very far away. And I think that whatever your feelings about this war are, we all as American citizens need to understand what these guys are going through so that when they come home, and they will come home, that we can make a place for them. If we don't understand what they went through, it'll be that much harder to make a place for them back home here in our society.
I'd jump in there and add that, if you are interested in peace-building initiatives in Afghanistan, or if you're interested in war extension methods, whatever that be, understanding what motivates young men in war, understanding their reality is going to inform whatever strategy you may seek to make. And so, that's why just really having a coherent view of what they actually do is important. And I don't think that it's something that you get in the States. You think you get it, but you don't really get it, because 2 to 3 minute network news pieces or the kind of, the pages of newspapers and magazines aren't really designed to give that impression.
Let's hear a cut from the documentary film Restrepo. This is specialist Kyle Steiner. He's talking about bravery.
I guess you could say that a normal person would say it's going above and beyond the call. Well, that is our call. Why call us brave? It's our job to be that way. So that's who we are. It's not, we're not doing anything extra that they seem to think we are. We're doing what's asked of us, and we do it well. That's why we don't use that word. I thought about that too. There's no reason to use it. I'm brave. Just somebody's got to do it.
He's just showing up for work every day.
Yeah, that's right. It's really interesting that soldiers really do have trouble with that word bravery. I saw two guys run through machine gun fire to pull an injured comrade to safety. a guy in the platoon. And I asked him about it later, and this one guy said to me, he said, look, he would do it for me. He said, that's not brave. That's my friend out there. I mean, that's what soldiers do. So soldiers, they don't think of, there isn't a category of soldier and then brave soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But then the two categories are soldier and coward. Brave is what it means to be a soldier. It's a matter of definition. It's like asking a fireman, you know, why did you run into that burning building to save that family? His answer would be, well, I'm a fireman, and the building's on fire. Like, that's just what the job is.
I might have read it, or I might have seen it in the film, but someone made a suggestion that it's almost a form of selfishness, that, well, it's my friend, and I want to save my friend.
Yeah, I mean, combat is a very personal thing. It's not political. It's not patriotic necessarily. It's very personal. It is about your relationships with the other men around you. It's a brotherhood up there, and brothers don't let each other die.
They were very cut off at Restrepo. Before we move on, tell us about where the word Restrepo comes from and who it's named for.
It was named after the platoon medic, Juan Restrepo, who came from Pembroke Pines in Florida. And early on in the deployment, Juan was shot in the neck. He bled out. His friends tried to save his life, but didn't succeed. And then they went up and they built this outpost on the side of the valley on a little ridgetop, and they named it after their friends. They called it Outpost Restrepo. And it was really the outpost that was at the tip of the spear in the Congo. I mean, you know, south from where that outpost was insurgent-held territory. And they were really at the brunt of the kind of company effort in the Congo.
And until they shut down that outpost, the folks that came after them, the soldiers, they kept the name.
They kept the name. And you know, in some ways, you know, we use the name Restrepo not just because it was after Juan or because mm-hmm. it was called the name of the outpost, but also we just felt the name was somehow emblematic of every soldier and the sense of loss and experience that every soldier goes through.
We have to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with filmmakers Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger. Their film is called Restrepo, and it is one of the 15 finalists for the Academy Awards nomination for... documentary. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. You can hear local news anytime you want online at WOSU.org. Now featured in our local news section, union protests, Bob Evans worker benefits. WOSU's Mandy Trimble has that story along with more from our award-winning news team. Online at WOSU.org in the local news section. And it's 44 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms are possible off and on throughout the day. Some storms could produce heavy rainfall and a high of 54 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Documentary filmmaker Tim Hetherington was killed this week at work in Libya. We interviewed him last November about his Oscar-nominated movie Restrepo and revisit that interview today. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger, the filmmakers of the film Restrepo. It's about 15 months in the Korangal Valley with the second platoon of Battle Company, part of a regiment in the 173rd Airborne Brigade. I was wondering how you got the soldiers to really open up to you. Like, they ultimately didn't know what you were going to do with the footage.
You know, anytime you start an assignment, you start a work of journalism, you're dealing with people who don't necessarily have a reason to trust you, and they trust you by getting to know you. And so had we just done a couple of weeks with them and left, it would have been a standard news report about a platoon, but we kept going back over and over again. We were there. Tim and I did a total of 10 one-month trips between the two of us, sometimes together, sometimes apart. We gained their trust by not being a burden, by pulling our own weight, by handling ourselves well in combat. We didn't complain. And I think they started to be able to tell that we did not really we were not interested in some kind of political analysis. We certainly had no agenda in terms of this story. We simply wanted to chronicle their experience. And once they figured that out, and they also got to know us as people, you know, we were, by the end of the year, we were really part of the platoon. And it was a very profound experience for both of us, I think.
You're both familiar with war zones. Was there anything that surprised you about this particular situation?
Tim, you want to take that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, both Sebastian and I have covered wars for a long time, and we've covered it from civilian perspectives. You know, I've spent my life kind of, well, my time working with organizations like Human Rights Watch. I've also, I lived in West Africa and covered civil wars there. This was my first time embedded with the U.S. military, and I was really surprised at how much I liked the guys. I thought they were a good bunch of people trying to do a difficult job in very difficult circumstances. And, of course, I mean, you have to take into account their age. They're 80, average age 18 to 23. And they're kind of dealing with the kind of the more difficult questions that many of us deal with as we get older. I mean, you know, dealing with life and death situations. So I had a lot of respect for them. And I guess what really brushed off on me and what was really profound was just this kind of this intimacy that we developed with them and understanding them, trying to understand them on a much more intimate level. And at the end of the day, you know, war is often seen through a political lens, but war is a very intimate act as well. And, you know, we abstract it as, you know, our desire to desanitize war, or sorry, to sanitize war. We dehumanize it. You know, we present images of the war machine as being kind of helicopters or missiles or you know, tanks. But in reality, the war machine is take a group of young men, train them together, put them on the side of a mountain, and they'll kill and be killed for each other. And it's something that's very intimate. And, you know, we have to humanize that in order to understand it. We owe it to them to do that.
Yeah, their age, 18 to 23, when I'm watching and listening to the one-on-one interviews you did after their deployment ended, they seemed a lot older, even though I knew they weren't. They just – was it their eyes?
Well, you know, you put weapons in their hands. You put them in uniform, in combat fatigues. You put them on that hillside, and they have a lot of presence. They have a lot of authority. They have you're not really reading their faces. You're really reading their sort of presence as people, and they're well trained. And so I kept in some ways, you know, the company commander Dan Kearney. He was 26, but he was in control of that situation. He was running the valley, and you know, I'm in my mid 40s, and in many ways, I felt like he was older than me, and you know, and in some ways, in a sense, he was.
Let's hear from a cut with Captain Dan Kearney, where he talks about his responsibility as a leader and about losing a soldier.
Being the very first day that I go out there, and the very first thing I tell them to go do, where I'm the only one in charge, and I get a son killed, I was like at a loss. I mean, what do I do from here? And First Sergeant just demonstrating to the boys that, you know, it's okay to do these things and grieve and cry or, you know, talk about it and everything like that. But we go out there, and the next day we get back after it and we do what we got to do.
He was
referring to the brigade sergeant major whose son was in 2nd Platoon, and his son, Timothy Vimoto, was killed in one of the first firefights on the first day that they were taking over that valley. And that was the brigade sergeant major's son who was in – the father was in Jalalabad at the time, not very far away. So that's who he was referring to there.
Was he one of the officers who visited the site during the film?
Captain Kearney came up to Restrepo, and the battalion commander came up to Restrepo.
Okay.
And I don't think the brigade sergeant major Vimoto, I don't think he was up there. He was certainly at the company headquarters about two hours walk to the north.
Do they get a lot of visits from their superior officers? Do they know what's going on themselves in those kind of places?
Well, I mean, we know just the experience of the Korongal.
Yeah.
You know, when we were up there, there wasn't a lot of visits. But what was interesting was at the time we were making the film, we were also on assignment for Vanity Fair. And another thing that kind of helped, I guess, the kind of the bonding process with the guys is that we were released. We released an article in Vanity Fair, and we also put out some ABC and Nightline piece. And
And that kind of revealed during the article, we kind of it showed a, you know, American soldiers were being killed. It kind of it revealed the fact that the Afghan war was kind of very, as the military would say, kinetic, and they were taking casualties. And suddenly the kind of focus did come onto the Korangal, and later, and towards the end of 2008, you did have people like Mike Mullen going out to the Korangal outpost, you know, and General Petraeus actually went up there as well. So suddenly the focus did swing into that area.
The film critic Roger Ebert wrote this about Restrepo and you. They use understatement to express strong emotions. The deaths of men they fought with are almost impossible for them to speak of. And I noticed that there was one of the soldiers who I knew he was in pain, but he was smiling during that one-on-one interview.
Yeah, that was Cortez.
Right.
He had a just heartbreaking expression because he was in a lot of pain. They all were after the deployment. We interviewed the soldiers in Vicenza, Italy, where they're based, after the deployment. We did studio interviews with them. It's the only footage that was not shot in the Korangal Valley. And Cortez just had this sort of beautiful, open face, and he kept smiling. And the worse the topic was that he was talking about, the more he smiled. And he was clearly struggling to sort of maintain an even keel about things that were incredibly emotional and painful to him.
I was impressed by how self-aware so many of them were. And one fellow in particular, very aware of some of the mental struggles that they're going to encounter in the future and maybe for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, that when we're saying about what surprises, I think, you know, that is one of the things that really surprised us about these guys. You know, many of us, you know, I said we go through life and we kind of come across the difficult subjects of life and death as we get older. And here they are, you know, these 18 to 23-year-olds dealing with these kind of existential questions. You know, and it's something you don't really often hear about or see back at home, because often soldiers are just used as symbols. You know, the right wing say they join out of a patriotic sense of duty. The left wing say they join out of economic necessity. In fact, the reality of each of these soldiers is much more complex and nuanced. And, you know, as you point out, you know, they're dealing with these issues and they're dealing with them in a really quite remarkable way.
There was the one soldier he called his mother, you know, the hippie. And actually, he was the one that talked most about himself, or at least the one that you left that was in the film that talked the most about himself personally.
Yeah, his name was, they called him Pemble, Misha Pemble Belkin.
Misha.
Pemble. Mm-hmm. And he was from Oregon. He was a skateboarder, snowboarder. His parents were, he described his parents as hippies, anti-war activists, who were also very proud that their son was in the military, and which may feel like a contradiction, but it really wasn't. And so Misha was this great sort of blend of experiences. You know, a lot of the guys out there had fathers who served in Vietnam or grandfathers in World War II. Misha was from a completely different background, and you know, one of the great things for me about that experience was that even just within that platoon, 30 men, you really can see all of America. You know, there was guys from Guam and the Philippines and Latino guys. There was one black guy.
Well, Restrepo was born in Colombia.
You have this all the variety in this amazing nation that we have. You had it all represented in that one platoon on that little hilltop.
614-292-8513. Give us a call. Tell us if you know somebody who served in Afghanistan, if you were there yourself, give us a call if you want to talk about it. My guests, Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger, made the film Restrepo, shot during 15 months in the Korangal Valley, one of the most dangerous postings in Afghanistan at the time. Denny, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good afternoon. Man, what I was wondering about is, we've all seen war movies and read books, and there is a lot of things that you absorb that's very stirring and admirable of the people. But I wonder, when you approach them, it seems to me you would want to be wary of not glorifying war, because we as a nation, it's a cliche, you don't go to war unless there's no other choice. Now, that's something we all give lip service to, but I feel that it's not really carried out that much. And how do you approach this? And I understand, I think, where you come from. You want to have a real even look just at what it's like for the people in the field. But I know you have to be stirred by the things you see. And how do you avoid glorifying these operations?
Well, you know, that's...
Or these people.
That's a really good point. And how we do it is that we're just incredibly... I think we were honest about what we were showing. I mean, in the film, it's a warts and all view. And one of the things we do show in the film is very rare footage of what happens when an American Apache attack helicopter, you know, attacks a house and kills and kills five innocent Afghans and wounds 10.
Yeah.
So we're not shying away from those things too. That those are also part of a fundamental part of the film because that's also part of war. And an even-handed approach is what we're trying to do. We're just trying to show the reality of it. We're just not politicizing it as we're just showing you the reality, I think.
Denny, thanks for your call. In a Washington Post review, they talked about how Restrepo forces the viewer to question whether limiting the account to the soldier's view is not merely another form of argument about war. So by not talking about the policies and the politics behind the war, is it making a statement?
Well, every journalist has to focus his piece or her piece, whether it's in the New York Times or it's a documentary or a TV news piece, whatever it is, you can't be all-inclusive. So what you end up doing as a journalist, and Restrepo very much is a work of journalism. We're journalists. That's mm-hmm. how we see it.
Mm-hmm.
Your work takes place within the context of all of the other great reporting that's happening on that topic. We don't have to all cover all of it. And so what I would hope is that people watch our film, and then they go on to read Human Rights Watch reports about Afghanistan. They read the New York Times. They inform themselves about the bigger picture. I think it would be a mistake to ask the New York Times to report about the individual personalities of all the soldiers that their reporters are with. And likewise, if you have an immersive documentary about soldiers, to then ask filmmakers to step back and interview George Bush about why he went to Afghanistan, it's a mistake. You're trying to combine two different things that I think won't go together very well, and the result will be a poor work that no one will watch.
It is an incredible, like the old proverbial slice of life journalism. I was just happened to be looking at Slate.com this morning. This might have been reported elsewhere, but this is where I saw it, where Afghan officials they're saying that the negotiations with the Taliban now have been being carried out with a man who's apparently an imposter. And the negotiations that so many folks were enthused about just a week or so ago have been largely pointless. It's not him. And it made me think about the process that I think it would have been Captain Kearney was going through when he was talking with the local elders. He had a weekly meeting with them. And I often found those meetings sort of perplexing. We don't speak their language. And I wondered how you can trust the interpreters, whether they're capturing the nuance of those conversations. How did you feel about it?
Well, as you point out, the meetings and with the elders are really a really fascinating part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And although we're filming from the perspective of the American soldiers, we're showing you all this kind of reality that they deal with, and we don't make any explanations. So the way that you feel perplexed is quite accurate, and the way you suddenly realize, like, well, can I trust the translators? Is quite accurate. It's about, again, looking to the idea of not making a political film,
mm-hmm.
but just showing the reality of what it is and letting you, the audience, make up your minds, you know. And, I think Dan Kearney did struggle with those things day in, day out. And eventually, April this year, the U.S. did pull out of the Korangal. And in fact, there was a cameraman embedded with the Taliban, with the insurgents from Al Jazeera. And it was obvious from looking at the footage that was released that many of the locals that Dan Kearney had been talking to, doing the shores with, were allied to the insurgents.
When you mentioned how the helicopter dropped the bombs and or were shooting at insurgents and ended up injuring or I think five civilians there.
And one killed, of them, killed five and wounded 10.
Okay,
yeah.
Killed five and wounded 10. One of the wounded was a baby.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I mean, it's the insurgents are often using houses to shoot out of, and we saw that firsthand. And you know, it puts the soldiers in a very, very tough situation. You know, how do you respond to that? How do you fight that kind of war?
Did they had to keep control of their emotions even then, though? They pretty much, it seemed to me, reserved their emotions and their emotional, I don't like to say outbursts, but their moments of emotion for each other.
Yeah, I mean, combat is hard and it's dangerous and it's encumbered by emotions. You know, you don't want emotions when you're in combat, when you're in a situation like that. And so even they were not even really in touch with their own fear. I mean, one guy, Brendan O'Byrne, said, look, I just wasn't scared. And he, you know, he was almost killed like everyone else there, you know, numerous times. So he said, I wasn't scared. I just put it on hold. I did not allow myself to go to that part of my brain until it was all over. And so if you're not in touch with your own fear, you're certainly not in touch with some kind of sorrow about the war, about Afghan casualties. You try to minimize your sorrow, your grief about the friends that you've lost. All of those things encumber you and will get you or other people killed. The guys really deferred those feelings until later. I think it's a very, very typical human reaction to trauma.
Colleagues of theirs in another unit, I guess, they had a big lot of casualties during a particular battle, and he was talking with, I think it was Captain Kearney, was talking with his men about how to respond to that, and he said the only way you can respond is by killing one of them and paying them back.
Yeah, he did say that, and that was in response to an ambush that was on Chosen Company. That was a sister company to Battle Company in a valley close to the Coronville. And I think at the end of their time there, they had taken, you know, killed and wounded rates of 80%. You know, there was patrols where there was a 20-man patrol, and everybody in the patrol took a bullet, either was killed or wounded. And one of those events, the Battle of Whatnot, is related in the film, and you see the kind of reaction to the soldiers to that, and it's really interesting.
It is. And then he gives them time. Well, he goes, I don't know, for those of you that pray, we'll have a moment of silence. And that was an interesting panning, the way you pan the camera across the different, what people were doing at that moment. Some just staring, some.
Yeah, I think as Sebastian points out, the war, is suddenly a very complicated emotional territory that these soldiers are in. And it's very, you know, we ask a lot of these young men. Again, it's they're young guys, and we're putting them in very tough situations. And that's why we need to absorb their experience as closely as possible. We need to discuss it. We need to discuss it as a starting point for the war. And we really hope the film enables that to happen.
We're going to have to take another break. My guests are Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger. They have produced the film Restrepo. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, Europe sends military advisors into Libya. BP sues over the Gulf spill. Deadly spring storms. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins later this afternoon at 1 here on 89.7 NPR News. And join us in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock for All Sides Weekend with Classical 101 host Christopher Purdy and a discussion of what's new in the arts in Central Ohio. That's All Sides Weekend beginning at 11 o'clock. It's 45 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms possible off and on throughout the day. Some of those storms could produce heavy rainfall, a high of 54. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Documentary filmmaker Tim Hetherington was killed this week at work in Libya. We interviewed him last November about his Oscar-nominated movie Restrepo, and revisit that interview today. Welcome back to All Sides. My guests are Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger, makers of Restrepo. It's a documentary about the experiences during 15 months of deployment in a very, very dangerous part of Afghanistan. You did not focus on the blood and gore. There were a few shots, but really nothing of the fatalities that you could discern as a, you know, just from watching the film. Why is that?
Well, that's not quite accurate, actually. Okay. We do show you know, Larry Rugel when he was killed, and we do show you know, injured and dead Afghan civilians.
But not super clear shots, though. To me,
we don't show the graphic nature of it, right? Because, you know, I mean, and those are things that I didn't put in the film, because seeing somebody the back of somebody's head blown out or seeing a young kid dismembered really is not serving any purpose. I think when you see the film, you'll see that you go on an emotional journey. Mm-hmm. That you respond to those deaths and casualties in a way that is will affect you, but you don't need to see the graphic nature. We want to reach out to people and get people to come and see the film, and I think that putting that stuff in just really is counterproductive at the end of the day. And it's something, you know, I do this for a living. You know, I go out to war zones, I make images of people, and I've covered massacre scenes in Darfur. And, you know, recording that kind of work has a purpose. But at the end of the day, we need to build a bridge to the public to get them to focus on these issues. And those kind of images sometimes, although useful to make, are not useful always to include. But we don't shy away from the topic. Those, you know, they are present there. They're just not in the graphic nature you're describing.
When you're going to make a film like this, is that something that you talk about beforehand?
We had talked a lot about it. I mean, we have images that are really unbearable to look at. And, I mean, war is ugly. And one of the things we had to consider was what the impact on a man's family was going to be. You need to inform, as a journalist, you need to inform the public, but you don't need to horrify a mother. And that was the balance we were trying to achieve. There's a scene where you see a soldier and his entire back and legs, his entire all of his combat fatigues, the entire back of him is covered and soaked in blood.
Right.
It's not his blood, it's the blood of his best friend who he carried down off a hilltop. The man had been shot in the head and he was dead. And you know, in some ways, that image of a soldier covered in blood, another man's blood, is, for me, it's a palatable image. It's not, hopefully, it is not going to, you know, ruin the life of the parents of that guy who died, but it does communicate the just ghastliness of this whole endeavor sometimes.
Hugo, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a question and a comment for both of you. I was first wondering about how do you see, if shown already, how do you see your film being received in other countries? I'm talking more about developing countries, perhaps Latin America or so. I'm a first-generation immigrant from Central America, and I grew up in that region of the world. I have been in the States for 12 years only. And when I saw the film, I saw that from two sides, from two points of view, the view of someone who kind of experienced or saw the presence of military of the U.S. in Latin America, but also as an American citizen. And so I'm wondering about, you know, how those images are being received in countries like Latin America or other parts of the world. I want to say the film was very touching to me. I really commend you for your work. And when I saw those young men and men in your film, especially, you know, in that situation, I was always thinking, what other choices do they have? What other choices do our country offer them, you know, to avoid perhaps going to war? They volunteer to serve the country, but do they have more than that option? And certainly some of them do, but I keep thinking perhaps, you know, even though they are volunteering again, do we give them options for life? Thank you so much again for your work. And, yeah, that's what I have.
Thanks, Hugo.
Hugo, thanks for your comments. You know, it's very hard for us to know how our film would be received in places like Latin America. You know, I'm a British. I live in America. I'm a filmmaker here, and so I don't really know how people will receive the film. I hope that they receive it in the way that you've received it, and it's great to hear you raise the kind of questions that you raise. And those are really pertinent questions to raise, and I don't have necessarily the answers to those questions. I'm just bringing back the material to pose those, you know, hopefully get people to raise those questions themselves and have a conversation in society about, you know, what do we do in this situation? You know, do we need security? How much security do we need? You know, the question of, like, is military intervention, you know, valid? You know, all those kind of questions, I think, are really important questions for society.
Yeah, I should add that I didn't get the sense from the guys in 2nd Platoon that really any of them joined because they had no options in life. They were all really pretty bright guys.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, you know, either joined because there was a military tradition in their family, or they were so incensed by 9/11 they wanted to do something about it. One guy was in 5th grade when 9/11 happened. He learned about it from his English teacher, who came into the classroom and told the class what had just happened. And he decided right then and there at age 11, I'm going to join the Army as soon as I can, and I'm going to make this right. And some of them, frankly, wanted to experience combat. They're young men. They want to test themselves. If you just need a job, if you can't get a job, and you just need a paycheck, you can join the U.S. military and change the oil on Humvees or, you know, cook food for the chow line very easily. It's actually quite hard to get into the kind of combat unit that we were with, the 173rd Airborne. They're one of the most highly regarded units in the U.S. military, and you don't wind up with them any more than you wind up on the varsity football team in high school. You have to really want it.
We have an email from Paul. He writes, did you ask the soldiers whether they would encourage their children, brothers, sisters, or friends to follow their path and become combat soldiers? If so, what were their reactions?
What the soldiers often said is, look, we joined the Army so that other people don't have to. It's a really personal choice. It's the same kind of personal choice as going to college. I was a climber for tree companies. I was an arborist. It was a dangerous job. I worked 80 feet in the air with a chainsaw. I did it because I really wanted that experience. So, the soldiers don't really think about it in terms of it being a moral choice or anything. It's like, listen, if you feel like you need that kind of discipline, that kind of experience, join the Army. If you don't need it, don't do it, because they only want people out there who really do want to be out there. So it's not quite as simple as that.
But I would add that there was one soldier, Aaron Hiar, who's in the film, and I remember one day seeing Aaron writing away in a little notebook, and I said, oh, are you keeping a journal? He said, yeah, I'm keeping a journal. And he said, if one day if I have a kid and that kid wants to join the military, I'm not going to say whether he or she should or shouldn't, but I'm just going to hand them the journal and tell them to read it, and then they can make up their own mind.
We have another cut. It's actually from the website. It's not from the film. It's of Staff Sergeant Sal Ginta. He describes his attempt to rescue Sergeant Joshua Brennan during an ambush, and it was one of the actions that led to him being named the first living Medal of Honor recipient since the Vietnam War. Let's listen.
I kept on running. I saw three guys, and there was two guys carrying one guy, and the one had his arms and the other had his legs. I only knew one of them, and it wasn't the one that I wanted to know. It was Brennan, and he was the one being carried away. So just running and shooting, trying to close the gap with him. I shot both of them. I killed one, I guess.
Now, that wasn't from the movie, but it is on the website. Tell us about that and what happened and how it led to the award.
That clip was we filmed that just recently before Sal was given the Medal of Honor, and he actually was awarded the medal for actions carried out on Operation Rock Avalanche, the operation that is seen in the film. And Sal was on another ridgeline watching over 2nd Platoon as we went down following a number of days of heavy fighting. And when Sal's platoon went to leave that ridgeline, they were ambushed at close range. Which resulted in a number of guys getting killed and wounded, and the enemy nearly dragging off Josh Brennan, who unfortunately later died of his wounds. And it was a pretty remarkable action by Sal. He'll be the first to say that he did nothing unusual or that wasn't required. He's just doing his job. But I think the family of Josh Brennan are very thankful that they managed to get at least the body of their son back, although he didn't make it.
You mentioned earlier, I think it was Tim, that soldiers are often used as symbols back home. And did you talk to them about that and how they're viewed back home by the rest of us often?
I never put that question to them directly. I mean, you know, they're very young. They're 19, they're 20,
right.
And they're very focused on their job because their job is deadly and very intense and takes everything that they have within them to do correctly. And I think they had some kind of awareness that there's a, you know, support the troops, you know, kind of feeling in the United States. And they do understand that there are people who are against the war back home. And their opinion is, look, I don't care if you're against the war. I joined to serve my country. My country sent me over there. I'm fighting for you. Whether you want me to be here or not, this is what I'm doing. And so they really disconnect themselves from the sort of political argument that's happening and that must happen in this country. They really disconnect themselves from it. They're very much like the police. I mean, like, the police are given a job, work it within your precinct to reduce crime, and the police don't really talk about the politics of crime fighting, the politics of unemployment that leads to high crime. They don't really go into that. I think they can't afford to. The soldiers are very much the same way.
Then we have an email from Debbie. She writes, I have not seen the movie, though I plan to, but I highly recommend the book War by Sebastian Younger. And, of course, I mentioned earlier that Tim Hetherington is, you're working on a book entitled, or it's finished maybe now, Infidel. Both of them are about your experience with this group of soldiers. How do the books differ from the documentary, besides one's a book and the other one's a film?
Tim's book is already out. So it's on the shelves, Infidel. It's an amazing visual account of these soldiers. I mean, they're different media. You know, my book is text, it's words. I'm a writer, mm-hmm. and I wanted to use words to describe what it feels like to be a soldier, the emotional terrain of combat. The book is it's not about Afghanistan. It's called War for a reason. It's about what war feels like. It's divided into three sections, fear, killing, and love. Those are the three primary emotional experiences, as I saw them, that soldiers have in combat.
And Infidel?
Same thing. Infidel is, you know, it's a photographic journey into the soldier's experience. In fact, like Sebastian, it's about really this heart of the war machine, this kind of brotherhood that gels these things together. I think it's also very, very, like the film, but even more so, it's a very, very intimate look. You know, I think having spent that amount of time with the soldiers, that really I got beyond the kind of the symbolic images of soldiers into something much more personal and deeper. And at the back of the book, there is interviews with the soldiers in their own words, which are really remarkable, in which, you know, they talk about stuff that you don't normally read in newspapers and magazines.
The film is also about, in a way, some of the boredom that they experience. In fact, there are long stretches of boredom. It's hard to imagine, though, because they're shot at almost every day. And how does boredom manifest itself in a place like that?
Well, there actually were days they didn't get shot at, and that was when they started to get bored. You know, a week might go by without a firefight. And you have to understand, at Restrepo, I mean, it's a 15, 20-man base on a ridgetop. There was no running water. They couldn't bathe for a month at a time. At first, there was no electricity until they got a little generator up there. There was no television. There was no internet. There was no phone connection to the outside world. There was no cooked food. It was bottled water and MREs and ammunition and sandbags, and that was their reality for a year. There were no girls up there. There was none of the things that young men like and entertain themselves with. And so they would get bored. When there was no combat, it was a very intense experience. And when you adapt to that psychologically and then take it away for weeks at a time, it's very, very difficult. And the way the guys dealt with it was, first, they got kind of testy with each other. That was when there were problems within the platoon, interpersonal problems within the platoon. They got through them, but that was when things got a little prickly. But also, they were incredibly funny. I mean, if you take a group of men, we all know this, you take a group mm-hmm. of men, you remove them from the women and children and put them somewhere for a while,
they get very vulgar and they get very funny. And that's exactly how these guys got through their year.
Yeah, effing this and effing that.
Yeah.
All exactly. over the place.
Yep.
They were funny, and there were lots of moments when I wished I could have heard the whole conversation. I wanted to hear what else they had to say. Well, I wish you every bit of luck with the Academy Awards.
Thank you.
Restrepo is one of the 15 finalists in the 83rd Academy Awards documentary feature category. Our guests this hour, Tim Hetherington and also Sebastian Younger, the filmmakers, they spent 15 months or off and on 15 months with a group of soldiers, and some of them made it, some of them didn't. Do you follow them afterwards, Tim, Sebastian? Have you kept in touch with any of them?
Yeah, absolutely. We're in touch with a lot of them. I mean, you go through a very intense experience like that,
yeah.
And you kind of make friends with people and you stay close. And just last week, we were in D.C. For the Medal of Honor ceremony with Sal Junta, his family, and members of the 173rd. You know, as I said, some of them have left. Very few of them have left, actually. A bunch of them are still, most of them are still out in Afghanistan. They've been redeployed in Wardak province. They're fighting. You know, Facebook makes the kind of communication easier. And, you know, but it's been, as I said, the making the film, it was a very profound experience for both Sebastian and I. And, you know, we stay in touch with the guys. It's they're part of our lives now.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger, that's all the time we have today for All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for joining us. We will see you next time. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.